Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival for Thursday night, second day of December, year of our Lord, 2015. Oh, I got a bunch of news, of course. Everybody's been watching, trying to find out what's going on in San Bernardino, California. We'll talk about that shortly. First, we'll talk about the point out what's happened on the markets today. Gold was down $15.60, almost 1.5%, to $1,054.20 per ounce. Silver was down 19 cents to $14.07 an ounce. Platinum was down $8 to $834 an ounce. Palladium was down $12 to $530 an ounce. It was all around a bad day for precious metals. But it wasn't that good for anybody else either. Dow Jones is down 159 points to 17,730. NASDAQ is off 33 points to 5,123. New York Stock Exchange is down 130 points to 10,389.20. Where are we? U.S. dollar index is the only indicator I'm looking at right now that was up during the day today. And it was up, well, it's actually up after. It's up 10.10 now. It's 100.12 on the U.S. dollar index. Crude oil is $40.13 per barrel. I don't know. What happened today? What happened today to push the markets? Almost all of them went down with the exception of the U.S. dollar. And it's difficult to know what's happened to make the U.S. dollar a stronger currency today. Does anyone know? I don't. There's a certain amount of randomness in all of this. There's a certain amount, and certainly unpredictability, volatility. But still, it would be nice if you could look for reasons and actually find them in a way that was somewhat convenient, you know, and credible. Not just convenient, but credible. Because, oh, that's why that, yeah, yeah. Oh, we can look back. I don't really trust technical analysis. I don't trust the charts, and a lot of people rely on them, and they may be wise to do so, but my reading of the markets is that it's not easy to be confident that you're getting a fair market indicator, a number that's up there, is that the real number? Is that a manipulated number? You know, if the numbers are manipulated, and a lot of people, including myself, think they are, what value can you place on charts? Following the charts, the Dow Jones is up X number of points today, or it's down X number of points. What does that mean if the numbers are manipulated? The most you might be able to deduce from those numbers is there are people in positions of power that want you to think something, one thing or another. Say, oh my gosh, the markets are getting better. Or, oh my gosh, the markets are not getting better, they're getting worse. But are the indicators, are you being educated by the indicators, or are you being indoctrinated? Are you being formed, or are you being deceived? And insofar as the indicators lay the foundation for the charts, I'm worried about it. I don't doubt that the charts have a certain amount of value. They can tell you what is happening, all right? Even if it's some invisible hand is causing the numbers to rise or fall at a particular rate to a particular level, they're causing that to happen. Well, it's not the free market that's creating those numbers. But nevertheless, the markets are being created, and presumably created, the numbers are being created by people in positions of power who have enough power to manipulate the numbers today, and presumably will have enough power to manipulate the numbers tomorrow. So does it make a difference whether we're using real numbers or manipulated numbers, whether we're getting our information from the free market or we're getting our information from the central planners in Washington, D.C.? Does that really make a difference? I mean, if you follow the numbers and you follow the charts, what difference does it make whether they are controlled by central planners, free market, or whether Jupiter is in Taurus or someplace? What difference does it make? I think it makes a difference, but I have to admit maybe I'm mistaken about that. Maybe, what difference does it make? You know, it's like playing dice with loaded, it's like shooting craps with loaded dice. Who cares if you know that the dice are loaded to come up a particular number? Well, you can make your bets and you can win and you can win and you can win and you can win. And a lot of people sit back and say, what difference does it make whether they're coming up seven just because they're loaded or because I'm lucky or because God is on my side or because Saturn is in the constellation of Taurus? What difference does it make? Point is, I'm winning. And I think the difference it makes is that in the final analysis, we want to believe we're living in a country that is based on a measure of honesty and integrity. And that means some of us have to take our losses from time to time, and we have to take them with a certain amount of good cheer, no matter how difficult they may be. We've got to understand that this is the real world, this is truth, this is life. And some of us go up and some of us go down, and that's just the way the world really is. We have to value that honesty and that integrity, in my opinion. We have to value it more than just winning and putting more money in your bank account. And I know that a lot of people listening say, oh, that's crazy. As if we could value something more than money going into our bank account. This radio person is nutty. Well, even so, it still seems to me that we would be better off living in a world where maybe the game wasn't rigged. And maybe it was based on truth rather than central planning. And the truth might not be as much fun exactly, but there's something about central planning, fixing the game, rigging the markets. It makes you wonder, are you really living your life? Right? Is this your life or is this something else? Is this Is this somebody else's life? Is this something that's been fixed and planned? And you're just kind of going along for the ride, and they've provided this ride. Here, climb on. And we're going to keep you happy. Fat, dumb, and happy. And we're never going to tell you the truth. And when you finally die, you will never have known the truth or even experienced the truth to any meaningful degree. Is that the way we want to live? Or do we want to live in a world where we have to deal with truth? The truth is there. We can count on the truth and sometimes accept the fact that that truth is going to be unpleasant and even painful. I'm inclined to proceed after the truth. I would like to live in a world where the truth was something we could rely on. We live in a world where you can't. Markets are rigged. A lot of people agree with that. Not everybody does, but I wouldn't be surprised if a majority agree that the markets are rigged. Politicians routinely lie. People aren't guilty, get blamed for things they perhaps as symbols. And I would feel more comfortable. I would feel more alive. I would feel more meaningful if I lived in a world that was not simply manipulated, supposedly to keep me fat, dumb, and happy, and you and everyone else in this country. But in fact, let's have it. Let's have reality. This is the one chance you have to live. Let's have reality rather than central planning. What else do we have? Well, we've got the active shooter in San Bernardino. Headline from, what is this, from the Washington Times. Male, female, San Bernardino suspects killed, terrorism a possibility. Team of gunmen killed 14 people and seriously injured another 17 at a San Bernardino, California Social Services Agency Wednesday morning, prompting a dragnet that led to a further fatal shootout with the police in the city streets that killed two suspects. FBI says it's a possibility that the shooting is terrorism. It goes on. We don't know what's going on there yet. All right. We know that 14 people have been killed. They may find more before this is done, but the number at the moment is 14. That number, maybe it'll change, or maybe that's accurate. Maybe that's the final count. Another 17 have been injured. We can sit back and we can all, oh, that's so sad, that's so terrible. You know, that's what Obama's going to do to some degree. Oh, my God, 14 people are dead. Well, yeah, I get it. It's a problem. But on the other hand, there's 320 million people in this country. And 319,999,900 did not get shot yesterday or today. Right? We can't be stampeded by human sympathies. Say, oh my gosh, 14 people have died. Oh, this is terrible. Let's get rid of the Second Amendment. Let's take away the right to keep and bear arms. This is what Obama will try to do. It's what he does every single time anybody gets shot. I think what we're really holding out for right now, we want to find out who are these suspects. We don't know yet. They've been shot and killed. They've apparently, two of them at least, man and woman, have been shot and killed who were apparently shooters in this attack. And a third individual has been captured and tried to run away. Maybe he's an innocent bystander. Maybe he's the third member of this team of shooters. We won't know. Who knows? We won't find out. I don't know right now. We may not find out tonight. We might not find out till tomorrow. Who knows? We'll find out if the guy is part of this. We'll find out whether he is an innocent bystander. We'll know that sometime tomorrow, maybe even tonight. But we don't know right now what we're waiting for. All right? Always, oh, so sad. People died. Yeah. A few people died. You know, out of 320 million people, realistically, this is not a big deal. I know it's a terrible tragedy for the people that died. I know it's a terrible tragedy for the relatives and loved ones, and I don't mean to make light of it, but I do mean to put it in perspective. This is not the end of the world, and it does not justify eliminating the Second Amendment. All right? And we have to move ourselves away from just the normal human sympathy that you can find. Oh, my gosh, 14 people are dead. That's so sad. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But listen, let's not be dumb enough to allow that to move us in the direction of repealing the Second Amendment. All right? And Obama wants, I don't know that he could get the Second Amendment repealed. I don't think he can. But he wants to install more government regulations. He wants to put more laws and regulations on the book to further restrict people's access to firearms because of 14 people, because two people, maybe three, killed 14 and injured another 17. It's not sufficient reason. It's the kind of thing where you can be played on. People in positions of power can use that as reason, as a pretext to buffalo people into doing things that are contrary to their interests. But it is an insufficient reason. What are we waiting on right now? We're waiting. What we're really waiting on is to find out who are the people who did the shooting. Were they black? Mexican? Muslims? Were they terrorists? Were they disgruntled former employees? Post office workers? You know, we're looking right now, who's going to take the heat on this one? Was it a couple of kids who were both on Prozac, depressed and taking Prozac? Who's going to be blamed? That's the real interest, the human interest in this, is who's going to take the heat? Who's going to be blamed? Who are they going to try to hold? And I don't mean just the individuals that did the shooting, because we're not going to do that, are we? We're going to blame a group. We are going to blame a race. We're going to blame a culture. We are going to blame a religion. We're going to find somebody that we can blame them all. It's crazy, but it's the way people work. I want to remind you, and I've done this before on this program, the purpose of the Second Amendment can be found in a document that you can Google for yourself. And you can go up on the internet and Google preamble to Bill of Rights. Preamble to Bill of Rights. You can find this document. This is a one-page document. It was a cover letter that was attached to the original 13 amendments that were proposed in 1788, 89, I can't recall clearly. 89. They were proposed in 1789. Congress sent the 13 amendments that were proposed, sent the proposed amendment to the states of the Union, and when sufficient, the states voted on these 13 amendments individually. They voted for some and not for others. And the windup was 10 of them were adopted to the were added to the Constitution, and they became what we call the Bill of Rights. And it says here in the cover letter, it says the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, that was in the previous year, expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. They're telling us that the purpose of the Bill of Rights, the purpose of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which includes the Second Amendment, the purpose was to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution. I don't have any powers under the Constitution, and most of you don't either. The only people who have powers under the Constitution are the officers, officials, employees, bureaucrats, right? Presidents, vice presidents, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court judges, federal judges, the people who have been empowered by the Constitution to do one thing or another, they are the ones, because they have those powers, they are able to misconstrue or abuse those powers. And the purpose of the Ten Amendments is to prevent that misconstruction or abuse. And when you read it, this isn't my thought, this isn't my words, this is what it says in the preamble to Bill of Rights. Google it. You'll find it for yourself at a .gov website, and you will realize, holy cow, what else could you do with a firearm? The purpose of it is to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution, it means is to protect you and me from the federal government. And the intended target for the Second Amendment, it's not ducks, it's not deer, it's not Great Britain coming in and invading or Red China pouring across the Bering Straits. It's to shoot at federal officials, officers, employees. That's what it's for. And that's why government wants to get rid of it. They want to get rid of that Second Amendment because they know they are the target. If they misconstrue or abuse the powers of the Constitution, they are the legitimate targets under the Second Amendment. That's why they want to get rid of it, because they know they're doing bad things. They are misconstruing. They are abusing their powers, and they are hoping to do so without getting shot. I'm going to take a break. A couple of commercial announcements. James Corbett will join us. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan for the past 11 years. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He has been prolific in terms of writing articles and producing videos that provide intelligent and insightful analyses of whatever is current in the United States, in Japan, in geopolitics. It's hard, it's really hard to imagine finding someone who's better informed than James. So James is a regular on our program, and he's here again tonight. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, as always, for having me on.
Oh, I always enjoy it. I always look forward to it. Always a challenge. I don't know if I'm capable of raising my game, but at least I try. China, I think, might be I don't know if you would agree that it's the biggest story with the special drawing rights this week.
It is the biggest story that otherwise would have been told this week, if all things being equal. But, of course, not all things are equal right now.
I understand that. I don't know if they ever have been, but it's like Animal Farm. Some things are equal, but some things are even more equal. The special drawing rights that are issued by the International Monetary Fund, do they serve the people of the world, or do they only serve the governments which are members of the IMF's special drawing rights basket?
Well, I mean, I guess that depends who you ask. The central banks would argue that they serve the people, but the best argument that they could come up with is they serve the people indirectly by serving the central banks that are serving the people, or so the central banks want people to believe. Special drawing rights are instruments that you and I will never see, will never feel, touch, taste, smell in any way. They have no reality whatsoever to you or I. They are only instruments that are dealt with by central banks as reserve holdings. And basically the idea is that if you hold SDRs, then you are able to claim in any of a number of currencies, currently four currencies, but as of October 2016, also the Chinese yuan. So if you have SDRs, you can use those as a claim to actually get Chinese yuan in exchange. Which basically, for central banks, is a way of kind of hedging their bets. They don't have to hold U.S. dollars in case there's some kind of big problem with the dollar. They don't have to hold euros. They don't have to hold pounds or yen or yuan. They can hold the SDRs, and it'll be any one of those things, depending on what they want to do. So it supposedly provides stability or some greater degree of stability to the international system, rather than having all your eggs in one currency basket. No, you have five different eggs. So that's the idea that they would try to sell it as. But for you and I mean, it's a pretty esoteric idea that this, you know, helps our lives in any particular way.
It reminds me of the scene in The Wizard of Oz where the wizard is going to hand out a certificate of commendation, whatever, certificate of courage. I don't remember. And then he gave him a piece of paper, and everybody, oh, my gosh. You know, people were impressed by the pieces of paper. Just last August, the IMF rejected China's application for membership in the SDR basket. And as I understand it, it told China that it would have to wait at least another year, maybe more, before its application would be reconsidered. It was my understanding that the U.S. government led the move to reject China's application in August. Now, just 3 months later, the IMF has invited and approved China's admission for membership. What happened in the last 3 or 4 months to change the IMF's decision to reject China and instead say, oh, wait, we changed our mind? Something happened?
I don't believe it was rejected in August. I believe there was some misleading reporting or misleading headlines that led people to believe that. But the IMF press release that was based on was saying that they were delaying the decision, and so that the implementation of that decision would not come in January of next year, like most people thought. It would be later on in the year. So the earliest point at which China could be allowed in would be up to a year later than people were expecting. And that was. It wasn't that they had rejected the yuan altogether. It's just that they were taking more time than they thought with the decision. So that really just delayed it. And the fruits of that have now paid off, and now instead of January 2016 being this new basket, it's going to be implemented in October of next year. But still, it's going to happen.
All right. Is the inclusion of China in this basket of currencies, is this significant or merely symbolic?
It is significant, and immediately so. Now that the Chinese yuan is a type of world reserve currency, not the world reserve currency, which of course is still the U.S. dollar, but it is now more on a more stable footing as a reserve currency, there will be more central banks holding yuan directly as reserves. There will be more global assets reallocated into yuan. Estimates vary, but AXA Investment Holdings, I believe, earlier this year, estimated as much as $1 trillion of global assets will be reallocated into yuan and Chinese bonds in the next 5 years till the end of the decade. So there is going to be a significant amount of boon to the Chinese government in this, in terms of stabilizing their own debt.
Does this pose a threat to the United States dollar? Or is it just a bump in the road? I mean, it's going to detract from the strength of the U.S. dollar. Is it going to be a significant loss, or
This is not the death blow. We'll put it that way. This is not going to be the end of the dollar, but it certainly is a signpost along the road that I think everyone understands at this point. There is a developing narrative of the U.S. dollar losing the sense that it is the center of the world and should be the center of the world. There is a growing sense among more and more people that, well, something will have to replace the U.S. dollar as the lone super currency in the world, backed by nothing but petroleum and good wishes. I think that sense of that narrative is developing, and this is clearly one important stage of that, probably one of the single most important stages of that we've seen, given the fact that since 2009, the People's Bank of China governor has been on record arguing for the SDR to replace the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. Fast forward 6 years, here we are with the Chinese yuan now being added to that basket and being increasingly used as a currency of settlement internationally. It is certainly a sense that the U.S. dollar is being eroded by each and every one of these decisions that are coming along, and this is one of the most important.
That's one of the things that surprises me about this, because on the one hand, you're telling us that the SDR is something that will never touch the common man, woman. It doesn't really have much directly to do with our lives, and yet there have been people that we've heard about for several years that are talking about using special drawing rights as the backbone of a new global currency. Are those projections that SDRs could be used for a new global currency, is that irrational, just a mistake, or what's happening?
I think it's actually quite the logical outcome of the system that has been in place now for 40-plus years. Ever since Nixon took the U.S. dollar off the gold standard and scrapped Bretton Woods in August of 1971, that has been a central breaking point in the world monetary system. Of course, before that point, the world monetary system was ordered along the lines of Bretton Woods, which, of course, Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. It was a meeting that took place between about 40 of the allies in World War II towards the end of World War II in 1944. And at that meeting, they devised the system that would become the backbone for the world monetary order, which was based on the U.S. dollar being the international reserve currency, and the U.S. dollar itself was pegged to gold at $35 an ounce. There was increasing problems with that system throughout the 1960s as the U.S. government was spending more and more money and obviously did not have the gold to back those dollars up. So a lot of nations started to get concerned about that. And then with Vietnam ratcheting that up even more, you started to get central banks like those in France and Germany starting to actually demand their dollars to be demand their gold instead of their U.S. dollar paper funny money. And once that started to happen and the Federal Reserve was losing its gold holdings down from its official, I think, $25 billion down to $12 billion by 1971, Nixon had to basically put an end to that somehow. So he just said, okay, no more gold redemption. And from that point, the question, of course, is, well, what on earth is backing up the international monetary order? What on earth is the ultimate backstop of all of this? And the only answer that was, well, there was no answer whatsoever for a few years until there was some really sophisticated engineering, international engineering that went on as one would expect, the same cliques that have been backstopping the world economy for a century or more. And it's an interesting story. I'm sure you'll remember the oil crisis of 1973, where OPEC embargoed oil to the U.S. and its allies and the Israeli allies in the Yom Kippur War. But what people don't know is that oil crisis was not just predicted, but actually engineered by the Bilderberg Group, which met in May of 1973, 5 months before the October crisis. They met in May in Sweden, and among the attendees there, of course, Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller and the president of Exxon, the director of BP, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, one of the major shareholders in Royal Dutch Shell. The Royal Dutch Shell president was also there. And at that meeting, they had a lengthy, in-depth, detailed discussion about what the oil prices, about OPEC and its ability to create a problem in the world monetary order by embargoing oil. They talked about this at great length in that meeting, 5 months before the oil crisis happened. And they said there is probably going to be an oil crisis in the near future that would send prices up towards $11 or $12 a barrel, which at that time was a staggering amount. It was currently at that time when they were deliberating, it was $3.01 a barrel. So that's a 400% increase they were talking about. And they were starting to strategize, well, what will we do in the event of this crisis, which, of course, hadn't materialized at that point. And you can go and read the meeting minutes that have since been leaked online where they talk about this and discuss the crisis and how they're going to have to create a trilateral group of Japan and the U.S. and Europe to deal with this. And they'll have to create a joint energy policy and all of this. Again, to talking about a crisis that didn't exist at that time, but 5 months later it existed. And how did it exist? Well, leaked documents now have come out showing that Henry Kissinger was the main engineer, the architect behind the Yom Kippur War. He was holding information back from Nixon in order to delay his responses. He was feeding information to Israel. He was brokering deals with Egypt and Syria. He was the main focal point for this, of course, David Rockefeller's right-hand man and one of the attendees at the May 1973 meeting. It led to the embargo, which then led to OPEC raising prices first in October of 1973. And then in December of 1973, the Shah of Iran demanded a price increase to $11 and I believe 65 cents per barrel, a 400% increase, exactly what they were talking about at that May 1973 meeting. And when Saudi King Faisal's personal emissary asked the Shah of Iran, why did you demand such an enormous price increase, the Shah reportedly said, in order to find the answer to that, you'll have to go to Washington and ask Henry Kissinger. So that entire crisis was organized and put into motion by the Bilderberg Group. And the second part of that operation was for Kissinger to arrange a deal with Saudi Arabia to backstop the international monetary system by getting Saudi Arabia to agree to price their oil in dollars, creating a huge demand for dollars, which they then also agreed to recycle through Wall Street banks in the form of U.S. treasuries. And with that amazing trick, they managed to backstop the entire world economy on oil. Now, that is a very, very precarious system that relies on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. It relies on oil bursts in dollars. It relies on military strength of the United States. And it relies on everyone playing along with that system. That is clearly a system that can be maintained at the point of a gun, but not forever. And now that the U.S. has clearly overstretched itself in Iraq, in Syria, and is losing that sort of international authority that it had as the monopolar superpower of the world, as that is eroding, so is the U.S. dollar and the petrodollar system that backstops the world economy. So really, the logical extension of the Bretton Woods system into the petrodollar is, well, we can't rely on the United States government for this. So why don't we just expand that? So now it's going to be the U.S. and Europe and Japan and the U.K. and China. And among those nations, now instead of one meaningless fiat currency backed up by nothing, we'll have five different fiat currencies backed up by nothing. So it'll be a more stable system. So as long as you buy into that fundamental idea that these fiat currencies backed up by nothing can be the backbone of a system, now it's just a question of, well, you can't have one country doing it. Let's have five countries doing it. It is a kind of a logical extension of that system, but a very dangerous one because ultimately it's still relying.
Is it a logical extension? Is it a desperate extension?
A little bit of both. But again, I mean, just like the Yom Kippur War was engineered and the oil crisis was engineered in order to bring about this system, I think crises are being engineered in the current monetary order in order to bring about the supposed need for this greater basket.
Someone has coined the phrase disaster capitalism, and I can't recall who coined the phrase, but it's just recent. Matter of fact, it might even be a woman. I can't think of her name right off the top of my head. She referred to disaster capitalism as being the predominant system that's in the world today, and what she means by that, I believe she didn't explain it, but what I think she means is a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. People should take advantage of crises, and we now have a capitalistic system that creates crises that can be exploited. All right, let's talk about that when we get back. We're going to take a break for a couple commercials. I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett, talking about disaster capitalism. It was a phrase coined, I believe, by Catherine Austin Fitz. And although she didn't define it in the interview where I heard her speak, I thought it was a curious phrase. And I think what she means is that what passes for capitalism today relies on creating disasters that can be exploited and to generate profits for at least some people, disasters for some and profits for others. I'm curious if you think that's a reasonable understanding of the term disaster capitalism, or is there a different meaning?
Well, to be clear, I believe the term was coined by Naomi Klein, the author of No Logos. She was also the author of The Shock Doctrine, which was subtitled The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It was published in 2007. And yes, I mean, basically, of course, the idea here is that the best way to move forward into a pre-planned agenda is to shock the system into change. And so the examples that Naomi Klein talked about in her book included the transformation of South America and the South American economy with the coup in Chile, for example, of course, organized in the United States by Henry Kissinger, surprise, surprise, and other such events like that, where, of course, a shock is delivered in order to change the system in a way that's conducive to the interests of those who are delivering the shock. I think it is a persuasive idea because it's demonstrable time and time and time again throughout history. And I think, again, there's no end to the examples that we could look at. And of course, shock again came up in centrally in geopolitics just a decade ago with the shock and awe of Iraq. So I think, it's a pretty easily demonstrable idea. And I think no one would really dispute the idea itself. The only question is who is wielding it and how. And I think that we have to look at events in the last several years, specifically economic and monetary events leading towards the we're still not there yet, but leading towards the growing clamor and calls for a new basis for a world monetary order. And I think we're heading in that direction. All it will take is a few more shocks and we will have people clamoring in the streets to do something. Please replace these U.S. dollars with something more reliable.
Do you think they'll replace the U.S. dollar? I mean, I've seen some reports where people, they are aware that the dollar is perhaps on its last legs. They are aware that the dollar has a lot of problems. But on the other hand, there's nothing sitting on the horizon right now where we could sit back, well, why don't we do this one instead? It doesn't appear that there is another currency that's immediately available that could replace the dollar. So we're going to keep the dollar because there's nothing else. Could it be that China, for example, if they had an ulterior motive for getting into the special drawing rights basket, could it be that they'd be happy merely to have a multipolar system of currencies rather than a unipolar system, which might describe what we've had in the past with the dollar? I mean, is it enough for China to just sit back and say, instead of the dollar being the one and only, we've got 2, 3, 4, half a dozen. Would that...
Yes, well, I mean, it's important to note that, of course, it isn't just China that's been calling for this. There have been a number of nations calling for this. And perhaps, I mean, the institutionalization of this idea comes in the creation of the BRICS, which is meant to represent this idea of the multipolar world. They're representing the developing and emerging economies and their growing importance in this international globalized economy. And there's a lot of things to say in favor of that system, but I think there is also, I mean, the underlying question of if the entire system itself is really a fabrication that that does not serve the interests of anyone, then how does the expansion of that system globally, how is that going to help us? And I think the answer is that it isn't. The question of is the U.S. dollar going to be replaced with a different currency? I think ultimately that comes down to, I think it comes down to semantics. And I think that the people who are implementing the shock are happy to allow whatever system will look and feel the most conducive to the population that they're trying to win over. So I think Americans would be very upset if suddenly they weren't using dollars, they were using something that is foreign, I don't know, yuan or something, I mean, to replace the dollars for their daily transactions. Of course, that would be seen as a takeover and people would be up in arms. But if it all happens behind the scenes in international agreements with the IMF and it doesn't actually affect the look and feel and taste and smell of their dollars in their wallet, then they wouldn't care. And so I think ultimately, I think it's going to be more of that type. I mean, just from a practical point of view, I think that's the type of replacement that we're looking at. It will still, I imagine, be dollars that people will be interacting in, but those dollars will be structured differently. In the same way that when Nixon went on TV in 1971 and said, yeah, we're not going to be redeeming dollars for gold anymore, and here's what it means for you.
Temporarily. That was a temporary situation.
Right. Well, if you go and actually watch his speech, he outlines that, oh, you know, this only affects you if you're buying foreign cars or you know, foreign imported goods. But for your day-to-day purchases, it'll actually help people who are buying, you know, in America, American-made goods, which, of course, was a lie. But, you know, I guess you could get away with it.
If you're pumping foreign-based oil into your crude oil in your tank, was that one?
Yeah. That came home to roost a couple of years later, didn't it?
Yeah. Where are we right now? Obama has been, he's been pushing the idea that climate change has to be dealt with, and we've got to do something about global warming. A lot of debate on whether that's true or false, and I don't know where the truth of the matter is and rest of that sort of thing, but what I'm wondering is this. If we aren't going to have dollars backed by, if they're no longer petrodollars, they're no longer effectively backed by crude oil. It's still true to some extent, but it's not exclusive. They are not the exclusive petrodollar. They are a petrocurrency now rather than the petrocurrency. If petroleum can't really back the dollar anymore, and special drawing rights from the International Monetary Fund, that looks like that's a little too strange to be backing for the dollar. I'm wondering, is it possible that they want to go into something like carbon credits as backing for whatever new currency is coming out, if there is one coming out? Is that too fantastic to believe, or is that one of those things where you can say,
I wish it was too fantastic to believe, and for me it is too fantastic to believe, but it's not really a question of my credulity, I guess, unfortunately. I think that's absolutely one of the balls in the air, and that's kind of a more pie-in-the-sky idea, but it is one that has been floated before, and it is one that continues to be floated by people who are extremely influential in a lot of ways. And this is ultimately the idea that it goes back to really a movement from a movement that really gathered and formalized itself in the 1930s, known as Technocracy Inc., which was started by a charlatan and a hoaxer. But ultimately, it became very popular, and its ideas still persist. And the idea was that the ultimate backing of our economy shouldn't be things, some commodity like gold or whatever you dig out of the ground. It should be something more fundamental. And what is our economy really based on? It's based on energy. So the backing of our currency should really be energy. It should in some way measure our ability to generate and to power and energy. So that's kind of like a petrodollar, but that's not really what they were talking about. What they were talking about ultimately was that our energy, the energy of the world ultimately should be budgeted, and that everyone should have their allowance of being able to spend their energy allowance for the year or whatever, and people would that would be the way that people would interact with each other. And that's kind of ultimately where the carbon credit idea and where that logic of that system heads. And it's a really huge idea to get your head around, but unfortunately, ultimately, it has been brought up several times in the past decade by very important people in different sectors. There was a British MP a few years ago who was talking about carbon credits for people in the UK, and once you spend up your credits, I believe you could either buy them or you'd be out of luck. You just couldn't expend any more energy. Or the Pope's advisor to his encyclical on climate change from earlier this year had in the past talked about this idea that there should be a carbon budget for all people, and they, you know, once you use up your carbon, you're out of luck for the year. This is an idea that keeps coming back, and again, it's a long way to go from here to there, but it's one of the scariest ideas, because of course, ultimately, I mean, it's not just taxing you for breathing, which is ultimately what they're talking about right now in Paris, but if that system was implemented to its logical end, I mean, it would basically be, you would exist, you would be alive at the mercy of the government, and if they decided, you know, you to reduce your carbon budget, you either become you end up living like a caveman, or you will be exterminated. And that's such an Orwellian system, beyond Orwellian system of control, that it's scarcely imaginable, but it has been talked about, and I wouldn't put it past them that they would at least try for a system like that, which is why I think we definitely have to keep our eye on what's going on in Paris and the type of agreement they do or don't come to.
I think, well, you know, again, my reaction to this is simply, I look at Obama and he talks about global warming, and I just don't have the impression that he's really sincere. I get the impression he's up to something. He's got an exterior, he's using this as a pretext to achieve another objective, and maybe that objective has something to do with carbon credits, and maybe not. We'll find out. Before we go, I've got one last. Doug Casey's got an article, Sitting Ducks in China's Bathtub, an Overture to World War III. It's always been true that war is the health of the state, but especially true in economic times. That's because governments blame their problems on outsiders. What he's bringing up in part, he's raising the idea that if we're having difficult times in the United States, we need a war to distract the public. And we can blame things on the war that we don't blame on the government. Is it possible that China would be willing to enter into a minor war, not a big nuclear war and the rest, but a minor war, just to have somebody to blame for whatever economic problems it's having right now?
Well, I mean, it's again, that's a phenomenon that's happened throughout history, but not in Chinese history very much. China has not traditionally been for the last several decades, has been a militarily aggressive state. So that would be a huge change. But look at what's happening in the South China Sea as they're developing and building up their navy. There is more confrontation going on and more kind of bold claims to this or that territory, which is certainly creating more tension. The next logical step after tension is some sort of actual skirmish. I don't think that they do want to go to that level quite yet, because the tension alone is enough to justify some of the tightening controls and the increase of expenditures on the military that they're doing right now. But if push came to shove, like any other government, I think, yeah, the temptation would be there to have a little skirmish, get people to rally around the flag, increase your military budget, and accomplish a lot of agendas.
Well, part of the implication here is that Washington and China could effectively, if it's true that war is the health of the state, and both of them have an incentive to distract their own people from blaming their own government, then it would be helpful to both sides. Why don't we start a war? Wink, wink. You know, we'll kill some of your peons, you kill some of ours, we'll bitch and moan about the Chinese can complain about us, we'll come to an agreement, we'll come to peace in, who knows, 18, 24 months. I mean, it's just is it a puppet show?
It certainly could be, and there's historical
reason, not even a passionate mistake, but just people say, all right, let's put on a little show for the peons.
Well, it's important for people to understand there are historical precedents for that, and that has happened before in history with kings and queens, you know, across the aisle, Britain and France, for example, cousins basically deciding, making an agreement, let's go to war, and for this amount of time, and we'll get people organized and rallied around, and you know, we won't kill too many of your people, you don't kill too many of ours. There were actual agreements like that.
Our industries, you leave some. Yeah. Some of the industries alone will tell you which ones.
Exactly. Well, of course, that was back in the day when armies would meet on the battlefield and fight gentlemanly before, you know, the 20th century destroyed all that.
I understand. And the people used to come out to watch the battles. They'd sit on the hillsides and watch the battles. It would be like watching a football game. Only the soldiers are getting killed, but the people are sitting there. The public is sitting there in the stands. They got a picnic basket and a parasol to keep the sun off of them, and they watch these two armies. My understanding, Napoleon and I can't remember who was the Englishman who finally stopped him.
Wellington.
Who?
Wellington.
Yeah, Wellington. Yeah, that's right. I thought I heard Lincoln.
I don't think so.
No, I didn't think so either. I thought, what? I'm really going to learn something tonight if it turns out. That's the way war was fought at that time. We don't have enough time to answer. I'm going to pose a question, but we don't have any time to answer it. No, I won't even pose it. I'll save it for next time. James Corbett, our guest. Thank you, James. Always appreciate having you on the program. It's always fun for me. Interesting. I learned something. It's fun. I hope the audience enjoys it as much as I do. We'll have James back next Thursday, barring the unforeseen. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, you and the audience, me, James, Frank the producer. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.